Hello and welcome to the History of the Germans, episode 59, The City of Straw. As you can hear, I have a terrible cold and I'm afraid it's sniffle all the way through this episode. I will re-record it as soon as I'm out of it, so if you find it irritating, delete it and then reload it in say 5 days again. If you cannot wait to find out what happens next, well, here is episode 59. This week we'll talk about Barbarossa's next moves after his disastrous 4th Italian campaign. It takes him a few years to come to grips with the failure of his great imperial program before he makes one last attempt to resurrect it. This episode also has an episode website to go with it where you can find transcripts, maps and images. And this time I will even tell you where to find the page. It's on historyofthegermans.com/59. Now before we start, just a reminder. The History of the Germans podcast is advertising free, thanks to the generous support from patrons. And you can become a patron too and enjoy exclusive bonus episodes and other privileges from the price of a latte per month. All you have to do is sign up at patreon.com/historyofthegermans or on my website, historyofthegermans.com. You find all the links in the show notes. And thanks a lot to Florian, Hans and Karin who have already signed up. On March 9, 1168, Barbarossa left Italy via the pass of Mont-Cenis, disguised as a servant and accompanied by only a small number of attendants. He even had to leave his wife, Beatrix of Burgundy, behind in the town of Susa, whose inhabitants he feared were about to murder him. He arrived in Basel on March 15th, and he was not going to return to Italy before September 1174, making these 6 years the longest continuous stay in Germany during his entire reign. So, how did he react to the catastrophe before Rome and the collapse of his imperial policy? Well, as we know, medieval monarchs are not exactly famous for oversharing, but we can get glimpses of his initial reaction from the circulars he sent to the German princes in September 1167. That is when he was still in Italy, raiding Milanese territory in a futile attempt to bring down the Lombard League. At that time he writes, quote, "The heavens were astonished and the whole world trembled at the news that certain cities of Lombardy, namely Milan, Piacenza, Cremona, Bergamo, Brescia, Mantua and the Mark of Verona had rebelled against our majesty, against the honour of the empire, without a cause. The empire that had been preserved until now at great exertion and with the blood of so many illustrious men and princes." End quote. He describes the empire as the Imperium Teutonicorum, the Empire of the Germans, for the first and the only time in his reign. He goes on to say that the Italian cities no longer wished to be ruled by him or to be subject of the lordship of the Germans, but that he would rather die than leave his successors with a much diminished Reich. This sudden outburst of nationalist sentiment is extremely unusual. Much has been made of this turn of phrase in the past, implying that people were beginning to think in nationalist categories. But it is important to remember that it is literally the only time the term is used, and that it is used at the point of extreme stress, when Barbarossa is still trying to figure out what had so badly gone wrong. Hence, I like to see it as the exception that proves that the medieval rulers did not normally think in nationalist categories. Now, a few weeks after this honour or death shout, he leaves Pavia to save his bacon. And as I said, he even leaves his wife behind as a decoy to escape his pursuers. That's a really unexpected behaviour for the man. There has never been any indication he lacked personal bravery. He was often found in the centre of the fighting, and he even took on menial tasks like operating the battering ram in the siege of Crema, an effort that nearly got him burned to death. So why did he run? It is not that he absolutely had to. He could have stayed in Pavia, and if the city could withstand a siege for long enough, relief from Germany would surely have come. The princes may not have been very keen to support the Italian campaigns anymore, but they were honour-bound to relieve their emperor. Now, I do not want to fall deep into armchair psychology, but it seems that Barbarossa is utterly shaken by the events of 1167. He had lost his army, he had lost northern Italy, he had lost the funding source of his policies, he had lost Reinhold von Dassel, his closest advisor, and he had lost the fight with Alexander III. his standing in Europe had collapsed. John of Salisbury wrote that, quote, "The ex-emperor, driven out in disgrace and shame, is a fugitive and an exile from Lombardy, has thrown his own Burgundy into confusion as he passed through, and has found all of Germany in uproar. Now the fall he has earned seems to be at hand." End quote. For the next 6 months, his chancery does not produce a single document. Barbarossa ceases to act as ruler, at least temporarily. Some chroniclers claim that Barbarossa had suffered a severe illness as an explanation for his inertia. Only gradually does he return to his previous levels of boundless energy. Political priorities had to change in light of what had happened. Now, for the first time since 1154, Germany becomes the center of Barbarossa's agenda. His long absences and regular demands for military support had eroded the ability of the imperial administration to maintain the peace. Feuding amongst the princes had returned with a vengeance. In his own homeland of Swabia, the Counts of Tübingen and Ralph VI were tied in a deadly struggle that had pulled in both the Dukes of Zähringen and Frederick of Rothenburg, the Duke of Swabia. And then his younger brother Conrad, the Count Palatinate on the Rhine, fought the Archbishopric of Cologne, pitting two of the Emperor's closest supporters against each other. The biggest source of turmoil, however, was Saxony. Henry the Lion as Duke of Bavaria and Duke of Saxony had become an overbearingly powerful force. Whilst Barbarossa had been in Italy, Henry had expanded his territory eastwards into what is today Mecklenburg and Pommern. These lands had been occupied by pagan Slavic people since the days of the Great Migration. Margrave Gero and Hermann Billung had conquered them, but they threw off their imperial yoke in 983. After that, they had been subject to regular raids by Saxon nobles, but a permanent integration into the empire was no longer on the agenda. That had changed with Lothar III, and it is now under Henry the Lion that these territories are permanently settled by colonists from Saxony and Flanders, and cities like Lübeck, Schwerin and Rostock are established. The last purely pagan society on the island of Rügen is forcibly Christianized in 1172. Henry built himself the palace fortress of Dankwarderode, now in the center of Braunschweig, a structure that rivaled any royal or imperial residence in size and splendor. In 1164 he had become engaged to the then 9-year-old daughter of King Henry II of England, Matilda. The marriage took place in 1168 with all the pomp and circumstance of a royal wedding. His position and demeanor had by now become so king-like in every aspect. For his fellow Saxon nobles, such arrogance was unacceptable. Albrecht the Bear and his sons, the Wittiner Counts of Meissen and Lusatia, the Landgraf of Thüringen and the Archbishops of Magdeburg and Hamburg-Bremen formed the core of the opposition. As we have seen, the Saxon have always been most insistent on their ancient rights and freedoms and defended them vigorously against emperors. Nor were they willing now to bend themselves to a mere duke. A veritable war had broken out between Henry and the Saxon magnates, which resulted in the burning of Bremen and the sieges of Magdeburg and Goslar. Barbarossa ordered the magnates and Henry the Lion to appear before a Reichstag, but the rebels did not heed the call. Only upon the third summons did they show, fearing that a no-show would result in an imperial ban. Barbarossa's efforts resulted in a truce, which turned into a more permanent settlement after Albrecht the Bear had died, aged 70. The settlement was, however, not at all equitable. Barbarossa had continued his policy of keeping wealth on side, almost at all cost. Underlying it was the notion that a united front of the by far most powerful duke and the emperor was the best guarantee for stability. But it wasn't much more than stability. The reluctance of the Saxon nobles to show up for the Reichstag is a clear indication that they either did not expect a fair hearing, or worse, did no longer respect the imperial authority. The silver lining in this otherwise quite grim time came from an unexpected windfall of the catastrophic events before Rome. By 1168, Barbarossa had very little allodial property, i.e. property he owned in his own right. His most valuable possession was the county of Burgundy he had received through marriage to Beatrix. His father and his uncle Conrad III had built up a large territorial power base stretching from the Rhine River from around Basel to outside Mainz and then along the Main River and into Nuremberg. but the majority of these lands had gone to Frederick of Rotenburg, the son of Conrad III, as compensation for missing out on the crown. Rotenburg also took over as Duke of Swabia from Barbarossa himself. But Rotenburg died before Rome, and he died without an heir, so Barbarossa consolidates the Hohenstaufen lands again. The other magnate who died before Rome was Welf VII, the only son of Welf VI, Barbarossa's uncle and friend. Grieving over the loss of his only son, the older Welf gave himself to a life of debauchery. Hunting, drinking, mistresses, lavish feasts and largesse drained his finances, so that he sold his rights to the lands of Matilda to Barbarossa in 1173. His true wealth was, however, the lands in Swabia around Lake Constance. Those he offered to sell to his nephew, Henry the Lion, who was, however, far too stingy to pay the old man on time. So Barbarossa came in, provided his old friend with the means to enjoy a little bit more of his carnal comforts in exchange for some of the richest lands north of the Alps. Next one was the inheritance of Rudolf of Pfullendorf, another member of Barbarossa's inner circle, who also lost his only son before Rome. This required a bit more finesse, as Rudolf was still alive and his daughter was married to the Count of Habsburg. But somehow he finagled that one, and another chunk of valuable Swabian territory came to him. To appease the Habsburgs, they were given the county of Zurich and the advocacy over the Abbey of Säckingen. So, if you had ever asked yourself how come that Wilhelm Tell and the Swiss Confederacy were oppressed by the Habsburgs, that is why. Then there are a number of further lands he received, again, mostly from his closest friends, who either themselves or whose male heirs had died on his campaigns. Some he bought, but some he wrested from the heirs in ways that weren't always cricket. I will not bore you with the names of all the places, but what he ends up with is a fairly coherent territory. If you follow along on History of the Germans /59, you can see the map showing the Hohenstaufen-controlled territories, covering a lot of southwest Germany, and an extension eastwards into the modern Czech-German border. This process went on until the end of his reign, at which point the personal territories of the Hohenstaufen were almost as coherent, as sizable, as those of the House of Welf. The sudden focus on enlarging the dynastic territory is probably the biggest political U-turn in Barbarossa's reign. Until 1168, his political concept was to create an imperial authority that lives above the squabbles of mere princes and cities. A Holy Roman Empire that is universal and that can demand allegiance and support in exchange for providing security and the rule of law. The funding of that entity should come from imperial regalia, rather than from the territories of the reigning monarch. He does not give up on that notion yet, but his build-up of the dynastic lands of the Hohenstaufen is clearly his plan B, should the grand plan of being the undisputed leader of Christianity fail permanently. But this is not the only strategic shift. His attitude towards a schism also moved. His anti-pope Charles III had died in 1168 and his cardinals had elected a new anti-pope, Calixtus III. Though Barbarossa formally recognized him, he never met the antipope, and he did little to support him. The papal project had clearly failed, and Barbarossa needed to find a way out of it. His biggest constraint was the Oath of Würzburg, where he had sworn not to ever recognize Roland Bandinelli as pope. As the emperor, he could not walk away from this oath without a devastating blow to his credibility and prestige, which is exactly the reason why prior to this, the emperors very, very rarely swore any oaths. In 1169, he came up with a somewhat convoluted, but at the same time genius plan. He had made the German princes elect his four-year-old second son as King Henry VI. He then offered that his son would swear allegiance to Alexander III as the only pope in exchange for a coronation as emperor. That would have solved most problems. Alexander could declare that the empire had returned into the fold of the Holy Catholic Church, whilst Barbarossa wouldn't have to break his oath. But it did not work out. Barbarossa insisted that all the bishops appointed by his antipopes, like Christian of Mainz and Philip of Cologne, remained in their place. That was something Alexander could not accept, since he had appointed his own archbishops of Mainz and Cologne. now with two archbishops of Cologne who will crown the new king. Schisms are messy and they get messier the longer they last. After this attempt had failed, little Henry VI was crowned king in August 1169 in Aachen by the Archbishop of Cologne, one of those appointed by the antipope. Now let's talk a little bit about his two brothers. His older brother Frederick had been sickly all his life and died either before or shortly after Henry's coronation. Henry also had a younger brother, who was initially called Conrad, but then renamed Frederick after the death of the eldest. He became the official Duke of Swabia, though at the age of three his father still ran the duchy for the next decade or so. Having a son who is king and another one who is duke means there are now options to strengthen the political position of the House of Hohenstaufen through marriages. The oldest son had been promised to the younger daughter of King Henry II of England, but that son was now dead. And so was the relationship with Henry II. Barbarossa had tried to forge closer ties with Henry II during the schism, as the King of England had himself a major issue with the church. That issue was called Thomas a Becket. This is not the place to go into detail on this, and I assume many of you know the story anyway. But as far as we are concerned, the important point was that Pope Alexander III had managed to keep both sides, the Archbishop of Canterbury and the King, believing he was supporting them. So Henry II never really came round to the imperial side, even though he did send some envoys to the Oath of Würzburg event. There was even a brief moment after the murder of Thomas a Becket where Barbarossa had his hopes up that England would come across, but that vanished quickly. The murder, as we know, backfired badly, and Henry II had to do penance before the shrine of his now saintly adversary, which also meant that it was pretty much tied for good to Alexander III. And so Barbarossa turned to Henry II's archenemy, King Louis VII of France, the guy who had stood him up at the bridge near Dijon in 1164. In the world of medieval realpolitik, this was literally water under the bridge. The two monarchs met in February 1171 on another bridge near another town. And that meeting is a lot more successful. They discover they have something in common. Both do not like Henry II very much, which is enough to agree a marriage between Louis' daughter to Henry VI. They also agree to a treaty of friendship and interestingly agree to jointly fight the mercenary troops of Brabantes that become a menace after they had returned home to the Low Countries from Barbarossa's campaigns. We can see a glimpse of the late Middle Ages here already. That marriage, however, never took place because Alexander III appealed to Louis' brother, the Archbishop of Reims, to block it, but a bridge was built between the Hohenstaufen and the Capetians that would only strengthen over time. With that project having fallen through, another appeared on the horizon, a marriage to Maria, the daughter of the Emperor Manuel in Constantinople. Now, that is a bit of a surprise, right? Last time we heard about Manuel, he had been funding the League of Verona and teamed up with Venice against the Holy Roman Empire. What happened? The thing that always happens when five guys team up to kick one. Suddenly they realize they only ever shared one objective, defeating their enemy. Barbarossa's five adversaries in the 1160s were Pope Alexander III, the Sicilians, Venice, the Lombard League, and Emperor Manuel. All of them felt threatened by Barbarossa's power in northern Italy and had buried their differences to overcome him. But now that he is gone, they realize they have very little in common after all. The first crack appeared in the relationship between Venice and Constantinople. Manuel had been fighting for decades in the Balkans and had just occupied the coast of what is now Croatia. That was within the Venetian zone of influence. Moreover, Manuel also had sort of control of Ancona on the opposite shore of the Adriatic. So Venice became concerned that Manuel could block their shipping routes. And with good reason, because that is exactly what Manuel wanted to do. It is the whole reason why he wasted money on Italian squabbles and wanted a foothold in Italy. Manuel was right to be afraid of the Venetians, because merely 34 years later they will put an end to the Byzantine Empire of old. In 1169, Venice ordered its citizens to leave Constantinople. effectively a trade embargo. Manuel reacted by getting in touch with Pisa and Genoa to make up the shortfall and had all Venetians on his territory arrested. He still had a problem. His navy was no match for the Venetians. He needed to stop them to come down the Bosporus and burn his capital to the ground. The only one who could prevent that was King William of Sicily. So, a marriage alliance is hastily concluded and William is promised the Princess Maria. So far, so good. But then an epidemic breaks out in Venice and suddenly there is no longer a threat to Constantinople from there. Manuel does not trust the Sicilians any more than the Venetians, and so he decides to leave William waiting by the altar, something William II of Sicily will never forgive. And so Manuel now has a spare daughter and an open slot for an ally. Having pissed off everyone else, Barbarossa becomes the only choice. Some negotiations ensue that go on until 1174, but nothing comes of it. An even more unexpected diplomatic effort was directed at Saladin, the ruler of Egypt and avowed enemy of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. They exchanged letters, and in 1173 Saladin's envoys come to Germany, bringing gifts and the proposal of a marriage between the Sultan's son and the Emperor's daughter. Now, that is quite something. An alliance, a marriage alliance, between the enemy of the Christians in the Middle East and the Holy Roman Empire. Anyway, that did not happen either. So whilst all this goes on, another line of diplomacy opens up between Barbarossa and King William II of Sicily, the unlucky suitor of Little Maria. He is offered Barbarossa's daughter Beatrice as part of an alliance between Sicily and the Holy Roman Empire. Now, after all this list of new things, this is a really new one. Ever since the Sicilians had appeared on the scene, the Empress had been fighting them tooth and nail. But now that the Lombard League had appeared, there's a tectonic shift. What is clear is that the great anti-Barbarossa alliance is breaking apart. In the end, their interests are not as closely aligned as they appeared. And even the imperial position in Italy had made a modest recovery. Pisa and Genoa remained at least positively disposed, if not supportive of the empire. And a not insignificant chunk of the lands of Matilda and Tuscany remained loyal. The city of Rome even opened its gates to Paschalis III, and even the rather useless anti-pope Calixtus III could hang on to the Holy City, at least as long as the Senate remained opposed to Alexander III. In 1174, Barbarossa concludes that he should make one last attempt to re-establish his old dream of the universal empire. As I said, he had invested much in his plan B and was in negotiations with all and sundry, even Alexander III, but the dream of world domination is hard to give up. If the grand coalition of the five major powers of Alexander III, Sicily, the Lombard League, Venice and Manuel had broken down on the back of internal differences, why wouldn't the Lombard League break apart as well? Cremona and Milan had been at each other's throats ever since the Italian communes had first emerged. And what about Lodi, Como, Novara, Vercelli or Bergamo? They really live happily under Milanese hegemony. Pavia was still standing and still an ally. In September 1174, Barbarossa appears with an army of 8,000 milites in Italy. Knights, there were not. Almost all mercenaries. Hardly any of the German princes had volunteered to follow their emperor across the Alps. The only names that are confirmed participants in the venture, apart from the usual gaggle of bishops, was Barbarossa's brother Conrad, Duke Aldrich of Bohemia, who owed the emperor his position, and the ever-faithful Otto von Wittelsbach. The only pass open to his army was the Mont Cenis, what is today the French Alps. That is the emergency pass, the one emperors take when things have been going badly. It is the pass Henry IV took in that winter dash to hold off Gregory VII, and the one Barbarossa had fled across 6 years earlier. None of the traditional routes could be taken, as all of them were in the control of the League or of Venice. That let him pass the town of Susa, whose inhabitants wanted to kill him last time he passed. Never one for mercy, he had the whole city burned to the ground. From there, the army progressed into Piedmont, where they meet up with the army of the Markgraf of Montferrato. Turin and Asti open their gates, and from there, instead of following the open road to Pavia, he headed to a red rag the Lombards and the Pope had put in his way. That red rag was the city of Alessandria. There are over 40 cities called Alexandria in Europe and Asia, from Alexandria in Egypt, Skendrum in Turkey, Termez in Uzbekistan, Merv in Turkmenistan, Herat and Kandahar in Afghanistan, and even half a dozen cities in Pakistan. The US alone has more than 30 cities called Alexandria. Not one of those would have brought the wrath of the emperor upon it, because they are all named after Alexander the Great. Alessandria in Italy is not. Alessandria was created in 1168 from a couple of small settlements along the Via Emilia. It was created by the Lombard League and they named it after, drumroll, Pope Alexander III. They definitely knew how to trigger this German warrior. Alessandria had to be destroyed. It did not matter that it was not even on the way towards Lombardy or that it was a modest settlement without a major garrison that could attack his supply lines. No, Alessandria had to be wiped out. It was a matter of honor and principle. Barbarossa's army had been further reinforced with troops from the ever faithful city of Pavia and now counted almost 20,000 men. The citizens of Alessandria, most likely less than half that number, were prepared to surrender as soon as the host appeared. If the city surrendered without a fight, the convention of medieval warfare demanded that the city would remain standing. And that was a no-go. Who cares about strategy and genuine military objectives when the reputation of the empire is at stake? The offer of surrender was rejected. So the army settled down for a siege. Should have been a quick thing. Alessandria had only been founded in 1168 and its walls were not completed in stone, but mostly of wood. Its defenders were the citizens of this new town, reinforced by just 150 soldiers from Piacenza. The Germans called it the City of Straw, and they believed they could make short thrift of it. But hey, were they wrong? The founders of Alessandria may not have been able to finish the city walls in stone, but they had dug deep ditches and redirected a nearby river to flow around the city. And these turned out to be formidable barriers. The siege started in late autumn, and the winter was unseasonably cold. Incessant rain turned the imperial camp into a swamp. The Bohemians deserted, provisions were scarce. It was ridiculous. This one horse town was resisting the might of the empire for 6 months. Easter 1175, Barbarossa agreed a ceasefire for the holidays, and the citizens of the battered settlement agreed. It was a measure of how desperate Barbarossa is by now. Despite being a holiday, and the promise of a ceasefire, he ordered 200 of his best men to enter the city through tunnels dug during the siege. His army waited outside the gates, ready to storm once the gates are opened from the inside. But the invaders were spotted and killed. The gates did open, but instead of a crack team of Delta Force, the defenders sallied forward, ran down the surprised attackers and burned the siege engines with all their occupants. On Easter Sunday, April 13th, Barbarossa burned and abandoned his camp. He marched towards an approaching Lombard army that was finally sent to relieve Alexandria. The city of straw had turned out to be a city of iron. The emperor, with his chastened army of mercenaries and the whiff of sacrilege hanging over him, is heading into battle against the Lombard League. Next week, we'll see how this pans out. I hope you will join us again. Before I go, I have to ask you something. I have now been going for over a year with more than 60 episodes in the can, and looking back I realize that I've spent a large chunk of time on growing the audience, mostly through social media posts and the like. I do enjoy this to a degree, but on balance, the time would be better invested in the actual content of the podcast, the website, and the offer to patrons, whose generosity, let's not forget, keeps the whole thing going and advertising free. So thanks again to all of you lovely patrons. But let me get to the point. Would you be prepared to put the word out about the history of the Germans? Post something on social media, maybe share one of the recent audiograms I posted on Twitter and Facebook, forward a link to the podcast to your friends and family, or write a nice review. If you endorse the history of the Germans, it's so much more powerful than me telling everyone how wonderful my podcast is. So again, thank you all for listening and liking the podcast, and I hope to see you next week.